Lecture 6, Augustine's Career as a Christian Writer.
Augustine, Philosopher and Saint, Lecture Number 6. We're now concluding our survey of Augustine's life. We've been looking at the Confessions for the past 3 lectures, his great spiritual autobiography, but now we have to look at the part of his life that goes beyond the Confessions. He'd narrated one part of his life up to about age 35 or so. Now we need to look at the rest of his life beyond the Confessions. That period of his life, the rest of his life after his conversion, can be divided into 3 periods. Think of them as the 3 periods of Augustine's career as a Christian writer, because his career as a Christian writer begins very soon after his conversion, just a few months afterwards. So you can think of the time that the Confessions narrates up to his 33rd year or so, and then the rest of his life, which is his career as a Christian writer. There's 3 periods. I'll call them the early period, the anti-Donatist period, where he's arguing against a schism called the Donatist schism, which I'll explain. And thirdly, there's the anti-Pelagian period, where he's arguing primarily against what's called the Pelagian heresy. In each one of these periods, he's doing quite a number of things, but the dominant theme in this middle period is the anti-Donatist writings. The dominant theme in his last period is his writings against the Pelagians. And the early period, he writes a lot against the Manichaeans, but he's also doing a number of other things, which I'll talk about. So let's start then with the early period. Augustine has rejoined the church. He's converted. His will is now wholly set on the search for wisdom, which is philosophy. He's not yet baptized, but he's put his name in to be baptized, and he'll get baptized in the next year in Easter, 387. The conversion takes place in the summer of 386. He gets baptized in 387. In between, he goes to Casiciacum, which is the name of a villa just outside of Milan, owned by a friend of his named Romanianus. He's quit his job as a teacher of rhetoric, and now he's thrown himself upon the patronage of this friend from Africa, from his home province, who owns this villa, about a day's journey outside of Milan. He retreats or retires to Milan and writes philosophical dialogues and studies philosophy. He writes dialogues modeled after Cicero, who wrote philosophical dialogues modeled after Plato. He pictures himself and his friends having philosophical conversations about the nature of God, about the nature of happiness, refuting the skeptics, and discussing the order by which God creates and sustains the world. And also, in these dialogues, he proposes a kind of program. He's got a big project going. It's a very peculiar one for a church father, and it's one he gives up fairly soon. But it's a completely philosophical and largely secular project. His project is to study the liberal arts. He's got a sketch of the 7 disciplines of the liberal arts, which later become the medieval quadrivium and trivium, if you know those terms, the 7 liberal arts. And he thinks of it as a graded progression. You go from grammar to rhetoric to dialectic, which is the same as logic, and you go on and on until you reach the chief of the liberal arts, which is philosophy. When you get to philosophy, then you go full-time into the study of wisdom, and the aim of philosophy is to catch the glimpse of the vision of God. Now, all of this sounds very secular, right? It's quite an astonishing thing that right after his conversion to the church, he's engaging in this really very secular philosophical project. And as I say, it doesn't last very long. But he's even going to write textbooks on the 7 liberal arts. He's going to write textbooks on grammar, rhetoric, dialectic. He writes a long book on music, which is actually the discipline of poetic meter, de musica. Music in Latin means the discipline of poetic rhythm. And he wrote a long treatise on how poetic rhythm reflects the eternal numbers of the intelligible world. Right? The rhythm in poetry is called numbers, and that's temporal numbers, and that reflects eternal numbers. And so you can ascend from study of these temporal numbers to eternal numbers. Well, all of the liberal arts are supposed to lead from a study of temporal, earthly things to an understanding of eternal things. Well, that lasts for a few months. And then he leaves Kosciuszko and goes back to Milan, and he gets baptized in Easter of 387 after being catechized by Ambrose, the bishop of Milan. And catechism here means the formal process of being instructed in the Christian faith to prepare you for baptism. So Augustine always thought of himself as receiving the Christian faith from Ambrose, right? Sort of Ambrose passed on the Christian faith to him in this catechism and instruction, and also by baptism. After he's baptized, he returns from Italy to Africa, although while he's still in Italy, his mother dies. We heard about that in the Confessions. He buries her there in Italy, goes back to Africa, and he founds a monastery in his hometown, in Tagaste, in Roman Africa. This is probably the first monastery in Africa. He's introducing really a new trend in Christianity into the old-fashioned African church. The monastic movement was a new movement at this time, especially in the West. So Augustine is an innovator. He is, in fact, bringing a sophisticated new form of Christian thought into the Bible Belt. It's like he went off to New York, right, to the Big Apple, got involved in some sophisticated circles of thought, and now he's back in Arkansas, right? He's back with his old friends among the fundamentalists, these Catholic fundamentalists, authoritarian Christians, and he is the big, sophisticated, philosophical Christian. But he's no longer the kind of snot-nosed kid who's always trying to show he's smarter than other people. He is, in fact, a big hit in the African church because in Italy he started to write treatises against the Manichaeans, the heretical group that he had joined as a youth. He knew all about the Manichaeans from the inside. He was just the person to write treatises against them and refute them from a Catholic viewpoint. And he used his Platonistic philosophy to refute them. And we've seen a little bit of that when we studied Book 7 of the Confessions, where Platonism was the great philosophical alternative to the Manichaean materialism. So he brings this Christian Platonism into Africa. He uses it to refute the Manichaeans. And meanwhile, the African church, the priests and bishops of Africa, are very impressed with this young man. They think he is hot stuff. So he's no longer the disagreeable snot-nosed kid. He is now the rising star of the African church. And as a result, the African church wants him. And that changes his life. Because one day, Augustine is visiting the town of Hippo. He leaves Tagaste for a few days, where he has his monastery, and he goes to visit Hippo on the seacoast. And he's in church on a Sunday. And the bishop of Hippo, who is preaching at the chief church there in Hippo, notices that Augustine is in the crowd, right? Augustine, this hotshot, rising Christian star, this very bright Orthodox Catholic who writes such good treatises against the Manichaeans. And the bishop starts talking about how the church needs talent like that, right? The African church really needs bright, smart young men who can lead the church against the heretics. And suddenly, all eyes turn to Augustine. Everybody looks around, and, well, the long and the short of it is, they grab him. The congregation grabs him and pushes him up front to the church, and right there and then, he gets ordained as a Catholic priest, or a presbyter, as they called it back then. He was ordained as a priest quite against his will. He wasn't intending to become a priest. This is quite different from his conversion. Remember, his conversion, he wanted to love God with his whole heart, mind, and strength. He chose to love God with his whole heart, mind, and strength, but he had this conflict of will, and his two wills were fighting each other. But finally, the will that he wanted to win won. But now, in North Africa, he's getting ordained as a Catholic priest quite against his will. This is not what he wanted. He wanted free time to study philosophy. He quit his job as a teacher of rhetoric so that he could have the free time to write philosophical dialogues and discuss philosophy with his sophisticated Christian friends. And now he's got a job where he's going to have to teach illiterate, fundamentalist African Christians about the gospel of Christ. He's no longer going to have the free time to write these sophisticated philosophical dialogues. He's going to have to spend his time teaching illiterate Catholics about the Bible. He's no longer a philosopher. He's a Bible teacher. He didn't intend that, but it changed his life, perhaps even more dramatically than his conversion did. Because of this ordination, right, this forced ordination as a priest against his own will, he became what we call a church father. All the great Catholic treatises, the treatises about Christian doctrine, and most of the treatises against the heretics, which became very important in his doctrine of grace, were all written after this ordination. And probably most of them would never have been written if he hadn't become a priest and then later a bishop against his will. That changed his life, and his will had nothing to do with it. Well, that initiates the early period of Augustine's career. His philosophical period more or less comes to an end soon after the ordination because he just doesn't have time for philosophy. And he starts writing a series of treatises against the Manichaeans. And he also does finish up a couple of treatises on Christian Platonism, including a very deep treatise on Christian Platonism called On True Religion. But the real culmination of the early period is the Confessions, the book that we've been discussing for the past three lectures. That's something that Augustine writes when he's about 45. He finishes it near 400 AD, looking back on his whole previous life. It sort of closes that chapter of his life, the early period, I've been calling it. And meanwhile, at about the same time, he's writing another treatise called On Christian Doctrine, which opens up the rest of his life. It's really the kind of theoretical foundation for the Catholic treatises that he will write about Christian doctrine for the rest of his career in his second and third periods. So those two treatises, the Confessions and On Christian Doctrine, are the sort of doorway. The Confessions looking backward to his previous career, On Christian Doctrine looking forward to his career as a Christian teacher. And that's basically what takes the place of this notion of the liberal arts. Remember that the liberal arts were the way to ascend to wisdom in his early philosophical dialogues. He called them the liberal disciplines, disciplina. Well, now, as a Catholic teacher, it's not liberal disciplines that are the road to God, but Catholic doctrine. So disciplina gets replaced by doctrina. The liberal arts get replaced by Christian teaching. Christian teaching now is the road to wisdom, not the liberal arts. The old philosophical program basically dries up because he doesn't have time for it. He is a Christian teacher. And On Christian Doctrine is the treatise that gives him the theory upon which, based on which, he will teach his congregation the truths of the Christian faith. So, about the time he finishes up with the Confessions and On Christian Doctrine, he enters into a new dispute. It's actually a very old dispute, but he throws himself into this dispute in a new way, full time, really. It's the dispute with the Donatists. This is really what I've been calling the second period of Augustine's working career. Now, in this second period and the third period, he'll also be writing some very, very long treatises, the treatise on the Trinity and on the City of God. Those take him years and years and years to finish. They don't fit this neat little chronology very well. They don't fit the periods. But aside from those huge treatises, most of Augustine's work in this second period did focus on refuting the people he calls the Donatists. The Donatists are a schism, not a heresy. They are a group of people, or a church really, who teach the same teachings that the Catholic Church teaches. But they're separated from the Catholic Church because they think the Catholic Church did something wrong. The Donatists are strictly an African group. They're an African church which basically said, the rest of the Catholic Church has contaminated itself. The rest of the Catholic Church is not the true church. quite a strange thing to say. There's a little sect in Africa saying all the rest of the world is full of a Catholic church that isn't really the church. We're the only true church. They broke off from the Catholic Church because they thought it was impure. Because way back in the days when the Romans were persecuting the Christians, which was now almost 100 years ago, one of the things that the Romans did was come to the churches and say, you have to give us your sacred books. And some of the Catholic priests and some of the bishops did hand over the sacred books to the Roman authorities. The Latin word for handing over is tradere. And the people who did this were called traditores, people who hand over. So they basically caved in to the persecutors. And thus, they were like a stain upon the life of the church. They were a pollution, right? They'd given in to the Antichrist, to the enemy. So as a result, say the Donatists, all these Catholic priests and bishops have contaminated the church in the following way. Every bishop has to ordain his successor, the next bishop, right? Every bishop in the church has to be ordained by a previous bishop and so on, right? There's this whole succession of bishops. One bishop ordains the next, and each bishop is ordained by its his predecessor, right? There's this whole succession. The Donatists said that because the Catholic Church has these traditores in its bishop's office, the Catholic bishops are no longer true bishops. Because all these Catholic bishops now in 400 AD have been ordained by bishops who are traditores. And the bishops who are traditores cease to be true Christians, cease to be true bishops, and they can't therefore ordain any other bishops. So none of the Catholic bishops are really bishops. And none of the Catholic priests are really priests because they were ordained by these Catholic bishops, right? This contamination has spread as history goes on because, you know, the continuity of the church depends on this act of one bishop ordaining his successor and passing on his episcopal office, the office of a bishop, to his successor. And that doesn't work anymore because the traditores have fouled it all up. So the Catholic Church is no longer really a church. Catholic bishops are not really bishops. Catholic priests are not really priests. And, most decisive of all, the Catholic baptism is no longer a real baptism. Because the baptism is administered by the priest, and the priest isn't really a priest, because the bishop isn't really a bishop, so Catholic baptism is not baptism. If you're baptized as a Catholic anywhere in the world, you're not really baptized. You really haven't had a Christian baptism. The only place to find Christian baptism, says the Donatists, is in our church, the Donatist Church. So you can see what a challenge this poses to the Catholic Church in Africa. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the history, the later history of this controversy. What ended up happening is in 411 AD, still while Augustine was alive and working very hard, they had a conference at Carthage, which is the chief city in Roman Africa. Augustine was there leading the Catholic side. The Catholics came, Catholic bishops that is, and so did the Donatist bishops. And by this time, Augustine was a bishop, right? He was ordained priest back in that forced ordination, but fairly soon the bishop of Hippo died and Augustine became bishop. So Augustine's a bishop. He and the other Catholic bishops go to Carthage, and they have a big debate with the Donatist bishops in this conference at Carthage in 411. But it's not just a nice academic debate. It's presided over by an imperial representative. That is, a representative of the Roman emperor who is a Catholic. That is, the emperor is a Catholic. The imperial representative is a Catholic. Guess who wins the debate? Right? The Catholics win. Now, Augustine's arguments were pretty powerful, and the Catholic side probably did win on points in the debate as well. And at any rate, the outcome is that the Donatist Church is officially suppressed. That is, the Roman Empire uses political means and legal means to outlaw the Donatist Church. Donatists are fined, and the Donatists' property, especially their churches, are confiscated. So that basically they become, well, illegal. There's no bloodshed, right? It's not like the Donatists are executed or there's capital punishment for them or anything like that. But they are officially made illegal. The political and legal authority of the Roman Empire is against the Donatists. So there's official sort of political suppression of this church. And the sad thing is, and the uncomfortable thing is, that Augustine provides the theoretical rationale for the suppression of the Donatist church. He writes treatises showing why it's a good thing to suppress the Donatist church, to make it illegal, to fine them. This is one of those parts of Augustine's career as a Christian writer that we could wish didn't happen. Because when Augustine does something, he doesn't do it by halves. Augustine provides a very powerful rationale for suppressing the Donatists. After all, Augustine knows all about free will. He's one of the great philosophers of free will. So he knows that you cannot compel someone to change their mind. You cannot externally compel the Donatists to become Catholics. You can't change their hearts by coercing them externally. Augustine knows all about that. So he's not stupid enough to say, oh, well, if we fine them, we'll change their minds. If we assess them a fine, then that'll change their hearts. He knows that's not true. But he provides a sophisticated argument showing, look, let's just make it a little harder to be a Donatist. Let's make it so that it's not so easy to be a Donatist. It has a cost. And maybe if you're only a half-hearted Donatist, the cost of being a Donatist, the fines and the confiscations, will persuade you to be a Catholic. One of his favorite sayings for this comes from one of the parables of Jesus. Compel them to come in. That is, drag their carcasses into the walls of the church. Inside the walls of the church, that phrase again. Drag them inside the walls of the church and make them hear the gospel of the Catholic Church. We can't force them to believe in it, but at least we can give them the opportunity to hear it, and maybe they'll change their minds. Of course, they won't all change their minds. We can't compel them to change their hearts, but we can compel them to get inside the physical building of the church where they're going to hear the Catholic teaching, and we can make it hard for them to stay in the Donatist church, and some of them will think twice about it, and some of them will come back to the Catholic Church. And I suppose some of them did for that reason. He really thought of it as a kind of harsh medicine for the Donatists, right? This is the medicine they need to get them thinking about getting back to the true church. It's a regrettable argument. Now, mind you, it's not an argument for, you know, killing heretics and burning them and all that sort of stuff. Augustine never envisioned anything like that. But it is an argument for using political power to suppress a religious movement. And it's a very good argument, right? That is, it's a sound, well, it's a tight logical argument for why you should suppress people like that. And that's the sad thing about it, is it's such a good argument, logically speaking. But Augustine was good at that. That's why they wanted him in the African church. Now, let me briefly introduce you to the issues in the Donatist controversy, because this will be very important for Augustine's theory of the sacraments. One of the issues is the purity of the church. Remember, the Donatists said that the Catholic Church was tainted, impure, fouled up by these traditores. The true church is pure, untainted, said the Donatists. Augustine's response is, well, no, the true church has sinners in it. The true church is not perfect. Not yet. It will be. Right? In heaven, it'll be perfect. But on earth, you can't expect a pure church. You've got to have a church that allows for people who are imperfect. Right? Now, there's a nice argument. Right? If that's the only argument Augustine made against the Donatists, we'd be happy. Most of us, I think. Second issue, the unity of the church. What is it that makes the church one church? Remember what the Donatists had done. They'd become a little sect. They said, the whole church throughout the world is a false church, except for us here in Africa. Right? Well, what about all those other Christians? Don't we belong together in one church? What about them? You can't just sort of separate yourself from the rest of the church that way, Augustine argues. And the unity of the church is not based on the purity of its doctrine or the purity of its bishops. It's based on love. What binds the church together is love. Because, as always, love unites. Love is a force that unites you to what you love. The church is bound together by love. And what the Donatists have sinned against in separating from the Catholic Church, they've sinned against love. They've refused to join in the love which makes the church one. And then the third issue, after the purity of the church and the unity of the church, is rebaptism. It's a key issue for the Catholic Church at this point. If a Donatist does come back to the Catholic Church, should you rebaptize him? Right? He's been baptized in the Donatist Church. Should you now give him Catholic baptism and thus say that the Donatist baptism isn't a real baptism? But if you do that, then you're saying just what the Donatists say about the Catholics. And really, you're adopting their theory of baptism. Right? So if the Catholics choose to rebaptize Donatists who join the Catholic Church, they're basically adopting a Donatist theory about baptism. That is a real problem, and Augustine's solution to that problem is crucial for his theory of the sacraments, and we'll get back to that in a later lecture. Finally, we need to get on briefly to the third period of Augustine's career as a Christian writer, which we'll spend about three lectures on in the next few lectures. This is the anti-Pelagian period. In this period, Augustine refutes not a schism, but a heresy, the Pelagian heresy. These aren't just people who teach what the Catholic Church teaches but have separated themselves from the Church. These are people who teach the wrong thing. They teach falsehood about God and Christ and the human soul. That's what Augustine says, and the Catholic Church agreed with him. In refuting the Pelagians, what Augustine ended up doing was developing his doctrine of grace, that famous, crucial contribution of Augustine to Western thought, which was the framework that the medieval theologians and Thomas Aquinas and Luther and Calvin and the present Pope all have in common, the Augustinian doctrine of grace. This was how he fought against Pelagius and his followers. Pelagius was a British monk who, he founded this heresy, although his theology is probably not as bad as later Catholics made it out to be. But he still gets the credit or the blame for this theology called Pelagianism. The basic idea of Pelagianism, according to its opponents, is that you don't really need help from God in order to be a good person. After all, God gives us all the help we need by giving us the law, by telling us what to do. God tells us what to do, and we have free will, so we can do it, right? Right? You follow God's rules, and you get to heaven when you die, because God rewards you for following the rules. That's all there is to it. And the only help God needs to give you is to give you the rules, to tell you what the law is. And you have the ability to obey, because you have free will. And if you work at it, you can become perfect. You can become sinless, right? You can use your free will and train it so that you become perfect and pure and sinless. Right? There's that theme of purity again. Augustine believes, no, you're not going to get perfect in this life. And furthermore, the law is not enough help. We need not just law, but grace. We need the divine inner help of God. We cannot obey God without God's own help to do it. Our free will is not enough. Our free will is free, but it's not free to obey God fully. Remember that problem about conflict of will in Confessions Book 8. He wanted to love God with his whole heart, but there's this other part of him that says, oh, not yet, not yet. Let's stay with the concubine for a while. Not yet. Give me continence, but not yet. All right, so you have this will to love God, but it's not sufficient. Free will doesn't do the job. It's not all you need. You need the help of what Augustine calls grace, God's inner help, which we're going to be talking about quite a bit in the next couple of lectures. Let me give you then three arguments that Augustine uses against the Pelagians to introduce you to the kind of writing he does in his third anti-Pelagian period. Why do we need divine help in order to obey God? Why do we need grace? Why is grace necessary is the key question. Here's three arguments that Augustine gives for why grace is necessary for us. One, Catholics pray, forgive us our trespasses. Right, in the Lord's Prayer, you know, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Most Catholics pray this every day, right? Forgive us our trespasses. Well, that tells you something about your life, doesn't it? If you have to pray that, it means you've been trespassing. You've been sinning. You're identifying yourself as a sinner. You need forgiveness. You need God's grace of forgiveness, right? When God forgives a sinner, this is grace. This is undeserved kindness, right? We don't deserve forgiveness, because what you need to have forgiven is precisely your sin, which deserves condemnation and punishment. But instead, God, in his mercy, forgives your sins. And that's what you're praying for when you pray, forgive us our trespasses. When God forgives your sins and your trespasses, that's grace. That's a kind of help that you couldn't have earned, because all you've earned is condemnation with your sin. So that's an unearned gift. And you couldn't live in God's sight without that unearned gift of forgiveness. That's why you pray for it every day. Forgive us our trespasses. Secondly, Augustine argues, not only do Catholics pray this prayer all the time, they baptize their infants. Catholics baptize infants, and that means that they need it. Right? You wouldn't baptize infants if they didn't need it. And through baptism, infants get another gift of grace and forgiveness, literally a gift of new life. We wouldn't be baptizing them if they didn't need that gift, Augustine argues. And thirdly, without grace, our love for God is not sufficient. It is servile. We don't really love God. We obey God out of fear. Right? We obey God's rules because we're afraid if we don't obey the rules, he'll punish us. We don't obey the rules because we love God. And what we need to do to really obey God is to love him with our whole heart, mind, and strength. How can we do that? Our free will is not sufficient. God needs to help us there. If we just obey out of fear of getting punished for breaking the rules, then we are on the way to damnation. We need to love God, and that gift, that love for God, is a gift of God himself. That's grace. We'll talk about it next time.